I want a world where all teenage girls believe that we're going to care even 50 years later. I wish that somebody had told me that when I was 15 years old.
Police arrest several Alaskans protesting Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh in Washington, D.C. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 25th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, new China tariffs have an already struggling timber industry even more concerned.
Got no timber coming from the state of the Forest Service that's going to put me out of business, and I got a tariff that's probably going to put me out of business.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
A group of Alaskans protesting the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court were arrested this morning outside the D.C. office of Senator Dan Sullivan. It's a sign of the mounting tension in the Senate, where a hearing is scheduled for Thursday on a 36-year-old sexual assault allegation, which Kavanaugh denies. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin spoke to some of the Alaskan protesters about their motivation and what they hope to accomplish.
Even hours after her arrest, Suzanne Walsh of Anchorage still wore the plastic ID band the police put on her wrist, and she clutched her charging documents.
When they wrote mass arrest, I believe that's civil disobedience. It wasn't, there's a word for when you block the hall.
Walsh flew to Washington, courtesy of an advocacy group called Center for Popular Democracy, to tell both Alaska senators not to vote for Kavanaugh. She and other protesters filed into Sullivan's waiting room. He wasn't available. Walsh says they chose to stay.
Then we decided to just start telling our stories that we wanted to tell him personally anyway.
Many had stories of abuse they and their family members had suffered. They sang and chanted. A spokesman for Sullivan says the senator was at a hearing and says no one from the office called the cops. But there are rules about protesting in the Hart Senate office building and a limit on how many people are allowed in Sullivan's reception area. Capitol Police came and arrested the protesters in the hallway outside the senator's office suite. Walsh says about 15 people were arrested, but she's not sure how many were Alaskans. She was proud to be among them.
All day today, I felt my mother's energy, my sister's energy, and my grandmother. None of them are alive anymore. And they were all abused in their lifetimes in unspeakable ways. And, you know, my sister committed suicide because of it. So, I felt proud.
She paid a $50 fine and was free in time for an afternoon protest outside Senator Lisa Murkowski's office. Molly Haig, originally from Fairbanks, helped organize that demonstration. She says a lot of Alaska girls are young when they suffer sexual abuse, like Christine Blasey Ford was when Kavanaugh allegedly attacked her. Haig says many girls don't feel they'll be believed.
And I want a world where all teenage girls believe that we're going to care even 50 years later. I wish that somebody had told me that when I was 15 years old, and I want to tell every Alaskan girl that we are fighting because we want you to matter today, tomorrow, and in 50 years.
Haig says she thinks Murkowski is receptive to their message.
Oh, 100%. I think that if there's one thing we've seen today, it's that Senator Murkowski has been more aggressive than any other Republican senator about an FBI investigation to try to find out more information.
But Murkowski isn't actually calling for an FBI investigation. In the morning, the senator sounded like she might be. She told CNN, quote, "It would sure clear up all the questions, wouldn't it?" But Murkowski struck a different note with me.
The response that I made was perhaps somewhat flip in the sense that, you know, if there was an investigation here, there wouldn't be as many questions.
Murkowski told me few people realize the Senate Judiciary Committee staff has continued to investigate.
That part of the information gathering process, I don't think has been clearly articulated.
More protests are planned outside Senate offices this week. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Some candidates for governor and the legislature say they'll cut the state budget next year. A recent report by the legislature's nonpartisan budget analysts show why that may be difficult. As Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports, the state will have to pay more next year for the same level of services as this year.
The state budget this year includes several items that will raise costs by $200 million next year. That's according to the Legislative Finance Division. They're the experts who provide nonpartisan budget analysis for lawmakers. David Teal is the division director. He says the report lets lawmakers know that some of the things the legislature did this year can't be repeated.
It's a heads up to the finance chairs and to other legislators that what they did with one-time money, etc., in the prior session can leave some holes.
The biggest hole will be from Medicaid. This year's budget includes $50 million less than the program is projected to cost. Teal says there isn't much state officials can do to avoid this cost.
If you're eligible and you go get medical services, the state's obligated to pay those costs. And you can't simply tell someone, spend less, because you can't. They don't control, the bureaucrats don't control the costs.
The second biggest budget hole is from the pension obligation. Based on the latest numbers, the state should contribute $38 million more next year to shore up government and school workers' pension funds. Another problem is that the legislature won't be able to draw on some funds that it used this year. An example is a program that is phased out, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund. There was more than $30 million left in this fund that the legislature used to pay for other costs. Teal says this was understandable.
We're not pointing any fingers at anyone for doing these things. Some of them are perfectly normal, good ways to spend money. They're just not repeatable.
Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman asked for the report. He's the chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. He says the report makes the true size of the budget clearer.
You can't clearly see the problem. It's difficult sometimes to get the correct solution.
Stedman says the report highlights the challenge of cutting the budget.
So the likelihood of the legislature going in and removing required expenditures, well, it's going to be politically challenging, put it that way. And we haven't had that discussion yet in the legislature.
The report points out an even bigger challenge for balancing the budget in the future. In addition to paying out the $200 million spelled out in the report, it would cost nearly $900 million more to pay for the full permanent fund dividends under the formula in state law. Teal notes that the legislature passed a law drawing from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government services.
As soon as we begin drawing from the earnings of the permanent fund and using them for government services, then the dividend competes with those other government services. There's no difference mathematically between paying dividends and spending money on K-12 or Medicaid.
The 10-page report is available on the Legislative Finance website. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The timber industry in Southeast Alaska has blamed a decline in business on fewer federal timber sales. And now it risks being penalized by one of its biggest customers. Tariffs will be placed on trees shipped to China, a response to President Donald Trump's latest wave of tariffs on Chinese goods. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Eric Nichols says about 80% of the trees his Ketchikan-based company harvests in Southeast Alaska goes to China. Alcan Forest Products sells mostly young growth. Spruce trees make up a big part of that. And last week, it got 10% more expensive to send abroad. Nichols knew the Chinese tariffs were coming. To stay competitive with the global markets, his company is going to have to eat that cost at a loss of millions of dollars. It's a blow in a series of blows, Nichols says. First, the supply of timber is way down.
Got no timber coming from the state of the Forest Service that's going to put me out of business, and I got a tariff that's probably going to put me out of business. So which level of worry do I want to worry about first here?
A big concern, he says, is that the tariff could increase to 25%. The Trump administration has threatened to raise tariffs on Chinese products by early next year. And Nichols worries that China will retaliate with the same, which he says could be the death of Alcan Forest Products.
How do I make business decisions for today when I don't know what the tariff level is going to be in January there. So it's almost impossible to run your business beyond a day-to-day basis here with the threats of tariffs out there on the product that you sell.
His company helps employ about 30 people. As of this morning, Nichols was on his way to a remote logging camp in southeast Alaska. And he says he hopes his trade war gets resolved soon. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, low student enrollment caused the Larsen Bay School to close. Now the community wonders what's next.
Once you lose your school, you lose your village. Both the culture, economics, all of that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by
Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state, from Valdez, Anchorage, and more. Information at flyraven.com.
Hackers are using various forms of online skullduggery to steal Alaska Airlines miles and sell them on the dark web. Northwest News Network's Tom Bonsi reports.
Tech writer Paul Bischoff went looking for black market airline miles and points in the anonymous, hidden part of the internet known as the dark web.
It's basically like Craigslist. There's just a bunch of listings for all kinds of stuff.
Bischoff discovered that piles of Alaska airline miles could be bought in exchange for Bitcoin, or another difficult-to-trace cryptocurrency called Monero. Hackers most commonly listed Delta SkyMiles and British Airways points.
Usually people won't find out that their accounts have been hacked until many months after, until they're ready to spend on those points.
And by then, they're gone. Bischoff, based in Victoria, wrote about this in an article for the online site Comparatech. He advises you choose a strong, unique password for your frequent flyer account and follow common sense cyber hygiene practices. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
The Kodiak Island School Board last week voted to proceed with plans to close the Larsen Bay School. As KMXT's Maggie Wall reports, the Larsen Bay decision was expected but still upsetting for the community.
Without the requisite 10-student minimum, the school district won't get state funding vital to keeping the Larsen Bay School open. And with local governments facing massive cutbacks in revenues, the district just could not afford to keep the school open. Expected or not, closing a school is like a gut punch to a community. School District Superintendent Larry Ledoux.
Well, it's tragic and horrendous to the community. Schools in Alaska and small villages are the focus of the community. It's where they have evening activities. It's where they gather. For many of them, it's where they went to school and their children went to school. So it's schools are deeply connected. Many times when the school leaves, a lot of people leave with it.
Betty McTavish has been teaching in Kodiak Island villages for more than a decade. She spoke at last week's regular Kodiak Island Borough Assembly meeting. She grew up in a town with 204 people, so she feels she can understand the issues that face villages threatened with school closure.
Once you lose your school, you lose your village. Both the culture, economics, all of that. So when you lose your school, it's really important, and it's important to our villages.
School closures are the end result of a number of chain reactions. Many in Kodiak and the villages feel the first link in the chain was changes in fishing regulations, which made it hard to get into local fisheries, and even harder to stay viable in fishing out in a village. No fishing, no local jobs, no money, no way to maintain a home. McTavish suggested the borough try working with tribal entities to purchase village homes so the kids could live and grow up in the villages.
Because if you don't have children, you don't have schools, and you don't have a viable community.
Superintendent Ledoux said the district has been working really hard to keep village schools open, including absorbing the loss of state funding.
Last year, two of our schools did not make count, and we carried them anyway, which means it cost us a lot of money. We just can't afford that anymore to keep schools open.
The count Ledoux refers to is the state student count, which takes place over a period of weeks each fall.
In Alaska, you have to have 10 students through what's called the October count. It's a four-week period where you have to maintain 10 students at least. If you only have 10 and one student withdraws the last day, and you have 9.99 students, the state says, I'm sorry, we're not going to fund your school.
The seemingly small loss in the student count translates into an immediate loss of $300,000 for school funding. Ledoux said many school districts in the state just closed the schools and locked the doors. But Kodiak is different.
We still consider them our students. The fact that we have to close the school is a bureaucratic law or regulation. It doesn't mean that we have to let go of the students. They're still ours.
That means the students in Larson Bay will still be connected to the town schools and will continue to get support from the district, including a half-time person to help parents who now will be forced to homeschool their children. I'm Maggie Wall.
The State Department of Education will pick Alaska's Teacher of the Year next month, and this week we'll have profiles of each of the five finalists from across the state. Chola Mall is a science teacher at Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, Mall's teaching style is rooted in making sure her students know about the culture and history of the land around them.
When asked how she'd identify herself, Chola Mall begins by explaining the meaning of her name.
My name, Chola, is a Cherokee word, and it means cardinal, like the red bird. And my middle name is Agea, and I share that name with my middle name with my daughter. And so Chola Agea in Cherokee means cardinal woman, and my daughter is Walela Agea, and she's a hummingbird woman one of these days when she's not five.
Mall is Cherokee and was born in Colorado, but moved to Sitka early in life when her father got a job at Sheldon Jackson College. She grew up immersed in two Native cultures.
I started learning Tlingit in the Sitka Native Education Program when I was five. And so I identify with both of those cultural backgrounds. And I have a really strong connection to place in Sitka with the Tlingit people.
Both of Mall's parents were teachers, and so was her sister. Mall initially thought that she'd be a rebel and just be a scientist, but later she changed her mind.
I was so excited about all the cool things that I was getting to do in Glacier Bay National Park, working for the USGS Biological Research Station and on their research vessel and getting all this cool oceanography stuff. And then I went into my sister's classroom and I realized that's really fun too. And that when you're in education, you're surrounded by givers, and you get to be a giver.
The Department of Education highlighted Mall's passion for sharing her background in the world of science with her students as a main reason for her nomination for Teacher of the Year. She teaches life sciences, biology, marine science, stuff like that. Her class load includes beginner-level integrated science as well as more specific courses.
I'm right now teaching a field research class, so I get to kind of take that background that I had in research and get to expose kids and give them some real hands-on experience doing real stuff and asking real questions.
Mall says she isn't just focused on tying her students to where they live physically. She also wants them there culturally. Mount Edgecombe has students from villages across the state, and Mall says she works to relay her sense of place in her teaching as well as connect the students back to their homes. She gave an example of a student from Savunga.
And he started asking questions about the stable isotope ratios of carbon and nitrogen in walrus and in his subsistence food, his whales. And so his mom sent him samples down, and he was actually able to test them. And then he found a conference that was happening in Nome. And he was the only high school student presenter at the conference. And he was able to make that connection back to home, even while he was away from home.
Mall says creating a passion for identity and connections between her students and their homes is the biggest source of pride for her. Well, that and being a mom and an auntie. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss proposals to change federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations and other subsistence-related issues, and invites public participation at a meeting September 26th, starting at 1:30 p.m., and September 27th and 28th, starting at 9 a.m., at the AVCP Regional Housing Authority Conference Room in Bethel. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Temperatures and yellow leaves are dropping across the state, and that means fall is here, in spirit, if not in technical meteorological terms. And for folks from other parts of the country who might lament the enjoyable and longer autumn seasons back home, the fall in Alaska can seem all too quick. So I asked Brian Brettschneider, he's the climatologist in our Ask a Climatologist segment, why that is. Why is fall so short in Alaska?
Well, there's a couple things that go on. One is, you know, with our decreasing amount of daylight, we just have less solar energy, and so the temperature drops. That's true everywhere, but what happens here in Alaska is, especially in the interior and farther north, once you start to get some snow in the ground, then your amount of solar energy goes to almost zero. Most of it just gets reflected back off into space. And so you end up with this really magnified effect of not just lower solar energy, but almost no solar energy. So the temperatures really just start to plummet. And so you end up going from kind of near summer conditions to almost winter conditions in a really short amount of time, particularly, say, from north of the Alaska Range all the way up, you know, to the North Slope.
There's this other sign of fall and then sort of the winter to come, and that's termination dust, which is somebody from Fairbanks. That wasn't really part of my vocabulary until I moved to Anchorage. But what is termination dust? What does that term mean?
It is an Anchorage-centric term, and it refers to the first snow that we see appearing on the peaks of the Chugach Mountains just to the east of Anchorage. As far as, you know, what technically qualifies, you know, sometimes you can have, even in July and August, you can have a little fleeting snow at the very tips of the highest peaks. And so is that termination dust? You know, some people will you know, kind of shout out, hey, there's termination dust. I kind of like to feel that it's something that's going to be kind of almost a horizon-to-horizon coating above, say, maybe 4,000 feet. What we had the other day was generally restricted to above, say, 4,500 feet. But then after the thunderstorm that moved through on Monday, there was actually some snow on the mountains above about 3,800 feet. Not very much, just a dusting. But I think it's fair to say that was probably termination dust.
And where do we get the term termination dust? I mean, where does that come from? What does that refer to? And how far back does that go?
Well, looking back, say, into the 1950s, the first reference that we found, and this is Rick Toman from the Fairbanks National Weather Service Office, found a Fairbanks Daily News Miner article from 1953 that references termination dust in Anchorage. If you look at the Dictionary of Alaska English back in the late 1950s, they define it as end of summer snow which falls on the surrounding mountains and hills, signaling the traditional construction season is about over and that workers will be terminated soon. So I guess that's the entomology of the word termination.
Your seasonal job is about to be up.
Yeah, I always thought it was the termination of summer, or the, you know, something akin to like the terminus of a glacier. But it's a little bit more practical than that for the workers back, in the early part of the 20th century.
Fall, termination dust, these things could be sort of relative to who is doing the defining. But winter will be coming. We know that for sure. And I wondered if termination dust has any kind of bearing on what sort of winter that we might have. And do we have any other sort of indications of how much snow later on in the winter we might get?
It's very tempting when we see if there's a freeze early in the season, or if we see termination dust in the mountain, it's very tempting to extrapolate, you know, what it means, what it might signal for the upcoming winter. A few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, we had a very solid coating of snow above 3,000 feet. So it was horizon to horizon, several inches, covered Flat Top Mountain, all the peaks. And that was on August 30th. And people here in town were saying, oh, you know what, this means probably going to have a big snow year. And it turns out that was followed by the lowest snow winter on record. So, again, it's tempting to kind of derive meaning from these early season events. but really there's no relationship between what we see this time of year and how the rest of the season is going to play out.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist based in Anchorage with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He checks in with Alaska's Energy Desk every other week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Well, warmer than normal temperatures are expected across Alaska next month. National Weather Service Climate Science and Services Manager Rick Toman, we just mentioned him a minute ago, says that's the October outlook from the agency's Climate Prediction Center.
All of the state, better than 50% chance for significantly warmer for the month as a whole. Doesn't mean every day is going to be warm, but a very strong forecast from the Climate Prediction Center for all of Alaska in October.
Tumman says the probability is especially high for the state's northwestern coastal region.
Better than 80% chance that temperatures will wind up much above normal. And that is the first time ever that the Climate Prediction Center has used probabilities that high anywhere in the United States.
Tumman says the forecast and level of confidence reflect extreme ocean conditions.
The dramatic loss of sea ice in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas over the last few years compared to the historical period. Also, sea surface temperatures in the Bering and Chukchi Sea are extremely warm again this year, even warmer than last year.
Toman also points to another factor in play, the forecast of an El Niño, which historically have made the interior warmer than normal. In the near term, the forecast is for wet weather to be pushed out of the interior. Weather Service meteorologist Jim Brader says the region is forecasted to transition from clouds and rain to clear skies. Brader says the clear skies will bring daytime high temperatures in the 50s with freezing lows overnight. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington, Maggie Wall in Kodiak, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.